Okay? Unless the pastor wants to call an all-night prayer meeting for me preaching tomorrow. Okay. You never know when a chemist preach, you know, especially if you have a communion service, maybe you'll get transubstantiation or something. I don't know. I will repeat the question. I think there's a microphone out there, isn't there, that you're going to... Oh, for record? I didn't know it was being recorded. Okay. Okay, so question. I'll try to summarize your question and repeat it for the recording. Who wants to go first? All right, we'll go home. No. Yes. Now, how am I supposed to summarize that? Anyway, so summary, is there a flow chart that we should be in your mind about what you should think when you hear evolutionists give a new evolutionary argument you haven't heard before? Is that a good summary of what you're thinking about? So all I can do is tell you what goes through my mind, okay? I have three sort of major categories in my mind. As far as, you know, I'm thinking about where this falls in. And one is this idea of cause and effect. I mean, is there any more basic scientific law than cause and effect? Okay. And so if they're talking about an effect, I'm thinking about, well, what's the cause of that effect? What's the mechanism by which this takes place? Okay. So you were talking about how they talked about, well, because there's a sun and there's an earth, and so that these arguments about the second law don't make any sense because all the entropy is sucked up by the sun and it somehow transmits negative entropy to the earth. And so my question then is, well, how does it do that? What's the mechanism by which it does that? And if you question them more carefully, they'll say photosynthesis. Okay. Well, then my category in my mind is complexity. Okay. In other words, how does complexity arise? And so, you know, Michael Behe in his book talked about the irreducible complexity. He talks about a mousetrap and how you have to have five parts to the mousetrap. You got to have the little board and you have to have the lever and the spring and the little thing to, you know, put the cheese on. You have these five things in order to catch mice. Okay. And so you think about, well, how did all this complexity arise at the same time, you know, for the mousetrap to be able to catch mice? So I was talking to an atheist one time, and he gave me a mousetrap without the lever on it. He said, "See, it still works." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You can use it as a tie clip." And I said, "Well, the point is it can't catch mice. That's the point, you know, not that I could use it as a tie clip." So that was him, the answer to my question about complexity. Okay, so that's the category I have. And then the third category is, does it violate the laws of thermodynamics, the laws that we know of? So I think you'll find everything falls in one of those three categories. Either it violates law of cause and effect, it violates complexity arising from chaos, you know, non-complexity, or it violates the second law of thermodynamics, somewhere along the line. And so that's how I think about it. I don't know if that helps you. But when I talk to congregations, people want me to give them a killer argument. Tell me this argument where they will then bow down and say, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He..." It doesn't work like that, folks, okay? God constructed this universe to be understood by faith, okay? Without faith, it's impossible to please Him. There is no argument you can give them that they can't weasel their way out of. Okay? So I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is. And so when you're witnessing to your coworkers and friends that believe in evolution, you really are praying for a miracle. You're praying that their stony heart will be turned into a fleshly heart that will be able to absorb the truth. Without a miracle, nothing's going to happen. It doesn't matter how many good arguments you have. Okay? This is more just to encourage you, okay, than to, you know, get this unsaved saved. Okay? That's a miracle greater than I can do. Okay? Does that answer your question? Okay. What else do we have? Okay, so how do we respond when people find missing links? Okay, so maybe it's Artie or Turkana Boy or Lucy or any of these. Okay, and the way I would respond is that these are isolated skeletons, sometimes partial, very partial, you know, and a lot of times we don't even know if they belong to one individual. Or if it's a mixture of bones or whatever. And what is it that connects that archaeological site or anthropological site with this group of bones over here? Or how do you connect those two together? And there's no connection except in their imagination. There's no way. There's no way scientifically they can connect Lucy with any other creature that they find somewhere else. Now, Lucy, we figured out later on, after a lot of stuff, we figured out that Lucy's a type of extinct ape, okay, that no longer exists on the Earth, okay, and we know that. And so they no longer talk about Lucy as being a missing link, okay. She's no longer within the, you know, the family tree. So sometimes it just takes time. For it to work out of their system until they become more rational and so forth. But no missing link that they find, so-called missing link, they have no way of connecting that isolated site with anything else in time or space. Okay? There's no logical connection between them except in their imagination. And if you read their literature, because a lot of them are very proud men and women, they argue against each other. Because they want to be the one to discover the missing link. And so they said the other guy's missing link is no good because of this, that, and the other. Just read their literature and you'll find out they all rail on each other, you know, because it's all in their imagination. There's no science involved whatsoever. Would it be distracting to you to have my wife set up for tomorrow morning while I'm talking?
We're going to do it right up there, too.
We're going to do it right up here? Is this where we're going to be?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. She's always thinking ahead to the next thing. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
What is that? You mentioned some about today, but what are some resources that you recommend to people if they're interested in anything that's more closely related to other institutes, or websites, or specific authors that you would recommend?
So what are the resources for Christians to use in examining, you know, learning more about this topic? And there are the major creation ministries that I can recommend to you, okay? I'm a member of the Creation Research Society, okay, CRS. And we are 600-700 members, and we all have graduate degrees in science, okay, to be a member and so forth. We publish a journal, and we publish articles online and so forth. And so that's a good resource. There is Answers in Genesis, which are the ones that have the Ark down in Kentucky. Okay, and they have a answer page. You can go online. You can type your question in, and you can find the answer just about any question known to man and not known to man on there. You know, on their answers page there for Answers in Genesis, and they do a good job. And then there is ICR, Institute for Creation Research. Okay, and I like ICR personally. I think that their explanations are more scientific and not on a popular level, more on a scientific level. And so I often go there myself. They publish a monthly magazine called Acts and Facts, and it has the benefit of being free. So free, I like free. So go to ICR, Institute for Christian Research, and get Acts and Facts for free, and you'll learn about all the current research in creation. And I don't read creation books per se, because by the time it gets to publication, it's already out of date. Because creation science is like any other science, it changes with time. And so things we thought were true no longer are true, and so forth. So I like to read the periodic literature. And then the last one is CMI, Creation Ministries International. And they really are an international organization all over the world. They're headquartered in Australia. And they put out a publication as well. So those are the major ones. CRS, AIG, ICR, and CMI. So anything from any of those organizations. So there's no excuse for not being able to find an answer to anybody's question. Between those organizations, you can find answers to almost any question you can imagine. And if that doesn't work, just drop me an email. And I have a whole team of scientists at Bob Jones University, over 20 creation scientists at Bob Jones in every discipline imaginable, and they could find the answer if I can't. Yes?
What is an example of something creation scientists thought was true in the past, but no longer believes?
Okay, so a good example is somebody was talking to me about this morning. Was the argument about the moon being young because of dust on the moon. Ever heard that one? So Isaac Asimov, back in the 1950s, he wrote a science fiction story about men landing on the moon for the first time, and there'd been so much accumulation of dust on the moon because it was so old, there's no atmosphere to blow it away, that they sink out of sight. Well, the NASA scientists got really worried about that, and they thought, well, maybe that'll happen. So before they sent the Apollo mission there, they sent a probe to the moon, and they impacted the surface and looked at it with telescopes to see how much dust there was. And it turned out not to be much dust at all. So the creationists took that and ran with it and said, well, see, the moon is young, because if the moon was billions of years old, there'd be all this dust on the moon. And that was one of the major arguments that they used back then. But then we found out that the moon dust is being welded to the surface of the moon by ionizing radiation from the sun. It sputter welds the dust and just makes more regolith. Okay, and so we don't use that argument anymore. Okay, because we found out more about the moon and the moon dust and so forth. So that'd be an example of something. Another example that I find commonly in churches. How many of you have heard of the vapor canopy? You heard of that vapor canopy? You heard of vapor canopy? So Henry Morris and John Whitcomb in their 1962 book, The Genesis Flood, wrote about the vapor canopy. That is, the waters under the firmament, above the waters above the firmament, he had this vapor canopy in the sky, and then it collapses and rains down and gives us the water for Noah's flood. Well, the trouble is none of the scientists could figure out how to make that work, either by getting sunlight through to the earth before that or getting that water from up there down here without boiling Noah to death. Okay, they couldn't figure it out. So the last creation scientist was a guy named Willow that believed in 1970s. I haven't read any creation scientist since the 1970s that believed in the vapor canopy theory. And yet when I speak in churches, I find people that still believe it. In fact, I made a mistake one time. I was railing against the vapor canopy theory, and I didn't know that the principal, who was also the science teacher, he had actually taught that in his class that day to his Christian school students. And he said, and he was abashed, of course, and he said, but it's in your Bob Jones textbook. And I said, no, it couldn't be, you know. And so we looked at his textbook, and he was using a really old edition. He hadn't upgraded his textbook. So we called Rachel Santapetra there at the BJU Press. I said, do you still have the vapor canopy theory in the new textbook? Oh, no, we got rid of that a long time ago. OK. okay? And so now it's written out of our textbooks, okay? So you got to keep the look at the copyright sometimes on these things. So there's two good examples. I may be able to think of more if I worked hard at it. Okay? Any other questions? Yes. So the question was, when I go to public schools, do we see a different response? We haven't been in any public schools here in the United States. We're in public schools in Australia. And they are so biblically illiterate in Australia that they couldn't even formulate a question. They don't know about Adam and Eve or baby Moses, or they think Jesus Christ is a curse word. They don't even know he was a person. So we're dealing with a whole different ball of wax there. But so I can't speak to U.S. public schools. They wouldn't have me in anyway. I'm pervasively Christian, as they say. So I would violate church and state for sure, somewhere along the line. That's right. So yes, so I can think of one occasion where they asked me to dress like a group of high school students. It was a religion class. It was in a Catholic school, and so I asked how many of them were atheists, and half of them raised their hands. So the nun was really upset, and then would say, "Why are we spending all our money in the Catholic Church educating atheists for the future?" And I thought, "Yes, why indeed? Are you doing that?" And the Catholic school is producing more atheists than the public school was over there. And so their questions usually were more about, why is there evil in the world? Why does a God allow evil? Who created God? And those kinds of questions, more theological questions than scientific questions for them.
I have a whole list.
Okay. Okay, I think every creationist would say something different, but one that I've puzzled about. Oh, the question was, what's the most difficult question for a creation scientist to answer from an evolutionist? And one I've struggled with is coral reefs. We see these corals that are built up on top of each other and form these coral islands in the South Sea and so forth. And, at the rate which coral grows now and so forth, it looks like there's, more time required to get that coral island than there was, that we have, in the creation time scheme. And so that's one that I've puzzled about and thought about a lot, about how that occurred.
So the follow-up question that must be that I'm going to ask is, what is the resolution of that particular one in your mind?
I haven't resolved it yet. Okay. I mean, there's still unanswered questions. Okay, and so it's something I'll continue to think about, and I'll look at articles and see. The trouble is, most of the articles about coral reefs come from a secular point of view, and so it's very difficult to find out what's true and what's just, from their worldview. Okay, so you're limited in what information you have. So there's some things you just got to put on the back burner, until you get a fuller explanation. So usually when you talk to somebody, like I said, people are not born evolutionists, okay? Nobody comes out of the womb saying, I believe in evolution, okay? It takes a lot of education to become an evolutionist. So usually there's some place where they got off the train, okay? And if you can find that, in other words, instead of trying to answer everybody's question about everything, if you can find out where they got off the train, you're going to be better off. So say, now, when did you first start believing in evolution? And I remember asking a guy. He said, well, we went to Specimen Ridge out west, and it has these these trees on all these different levels up the ridge, you know, from different geological eras and so forth. And I couldn't explain that from a creationist point of view. And so, therefore, that's what made me become an evolutionist. That was that. And so once you get something like that, you can go to one of those websites and look it up and find out what the answer is. It turns out Specimen Ridge, it's these polystrate logs that they turned this way and they went down, and they sort of planned this out. And if you look under the so-called forest on Specimen Ridge, you find there's no roots. They've been sheared off by a volcanic blast, and then they ended up there, upright, in an upright position. It's not a forest at all. So once you find out what their problem is, you can find the answer to it, and then that's where you attack. That's where you give them the answer, is wherever they got off the boat. You can work your way back from that. So it's not like you have to answer everything about everything. You just need to find out what that argument was that made them stop believing in God and Christianity and go the other direction. Does that make sense? Okay. So, but with things like that, with like the coral reefs, that I haven't found an argument, that satisfies me yet. I'm just putting it on the back burner, and someday science will catch up to it. Okay. It could be the coral reefs grew a lot faster, in past years, because of the temperature, the chemical concentration of the ocean, that kind of thing. I have other ones that I have on the back burner too. If you really want to know what they are, you want to destroy the faith of your congregation. Okay, I'd be happy to. So when we get together as creation conferences and so forth, we talk about these things. What are the hard questions? For example, Michael Ord asked me at the last creation conference where I was, he asked me if I could research how do salt domes form in a flood geology world and so forth. How do you get these big domes of salt under the earth and so forth? And he said there's been very little research. He said, you're a chemist. You should be able to figure this out and write an article about it. But I decided to wander the country and talk instead. So maybe when I'm old and decrepit and I have time, I can research that. So there's still need for creation science, still need for young people to become creation scientists to figure out some of these things. It's not like all the answers came down on a sheet to Henry Morris, okay? There's still research to be done, things we don't understand about creation that we need to work on. Yes? Yes, that's certainly the case. I think all our knowledge would be much improved in 10,000 years, for sure. Yes, sir? So the question is there a younger crop of creations coming up after us old guys? Okay. And the answer is yes. So I'll give you an example. Vincenzo Antoniani is a botanist from Naples, Italy. And he happens to teach botany for us at Bob Jones. So my botanist retired, Dr. Ranieri, and I thought, I'm the division chair, so where am I going to get? I have to get somebody who's a young earth creationist, a Christian young earth creationist, has a PhD in botany, who can teach botany, who likes to teach botany, who will work for what we pay. And so that was a diminishing number. So here I get an application from Vincenzo Antoniani from Naples, Italy. What's the chances of that working out? So Vincenzo, growing up in Naples, he only knew one church, and it was Catholic Church. So he asked the priest what the meaning of life was. The priest didn't give him a suitable answer, so he gave up on the Catholic Church. He came as an exchange student to Virginia Tech. And there was a Korean girl, South Korean girl, was working in his lab. He asked her that question. And she said, we need to have a Bible study. And so she led him to the Lord and then married him. And then he did a postdoc in Michigan. And he felt really impressed to use his talents as a botanist in a Christian setting. He said, the pastor, do you know of any Christian schools that could use a botanist? Not knowing, I was looking for one at the time. And the pastor's wife was a Bob Jones grad, and they said the only one we could possibly think of would be Bob Jones University that has a well-developed science program that could use a botanist. And so that's where I got the application. Okay, so I said, here he is sitting in front of me. And I said, well, how old do you think the earth is? Because my job is to keep the theistic evolutionists out of the department. And he said, I don't know. He said, I just believe the Bible, whatever the Bible says. You know, he's talking with his hands. And I said, well, what creation books have you read? I haven't read any creation books. He said, I just believe whatever the Bible says. And I said, okay. I said, what about evolution? Ha! Evolution, he said, even before I was a Christian, I didn't believe that stuff. It didn't make any sense. And so how could you not hire a guy like that? So now he has developed into sort of the creation research resource for Italy. So if you have a question in Italy and you write in Italian and these websites and ask a question, he'll respond back in Italian. And so how old's Vincenzo, would you say? In his 40s and so. So, you know, he's come along. And so, yeah, there's a whole raft of them coming up behind us. So you don't have to worry about it, the movement going away. I think what kills it more than anything else is the way we teach it in schools. We teach the young people that it's a settled matter, that, you know, like it did come on a sheet to Henry Morris or something, that we've got it all worked out, and they don't see any room for them. They don't see that they have anything to contribute, so it's boring. Okay, we need to let them know there's questions that still need to be answered, and we still need creation scientists to figure things out and give them the idea that they can make a contribution, that in another generation we'll know more than we know now. Another question?
I do.
Okay.
Early in the day, you showed a graphic of a 1 degree centigrade change over 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard from that, don't be concerned about a 1 degree change over 100 years. But I'm no scientist, but I can do math. Over 1,000 years, that's a 10 degree change. Isn't that a problem?
Oh, sure, it would be. But the change we've seen over the course of history has been in the region of more like 4 degrees over, you know, what we can measure for human history.
So the 1 degree over the last 100
yes.
is not typical of it's not what's happened since the flood.
That's right. That's right. So it seems like the warming has accelerated. Now, if you ask me whether that accelerated warming is because of man's activities, I would say I'm an agnostic again. Okay, that I can't tell you how much of that would be because of industrialization. Okay, should we be concerned about it? Well, I'm not usually concerned about things I can't do anything about. Okay, so would I build a big fancy house on the ocean? No. Okay, I would pull back. Okay. And I would say if we have some extra money laying around, we'd do it like we always do, adapt to the new reality, okay? That we know things are warming up, so we're going to think about what crops can be adapted to, what areas and so forth, what's going to happen if it dries out here and it's wetter here and so forth. And so we need to take the resources we have and adapt to the situation we find ourselves in. So I'm not concerned at it per se. I believe the Lord's coming back soon. Okay, so I'm not concerned about it like some people are. But this world is wearing out. It's wearing out more rapidly than it was in the past. So the shelf life is, you know, there's a bye-bye date. Like the milk carton, there's a bye-bye date on the earth. And I don't know what it is, but it's there. And so are we concerned about the fact that it's, well, we're not concerned because we're looking for redemption from on high. Anything else? Yes?
So if you go on the canopy theory, what was the atmosphere in Eden? And where did the rain for Noah's floods come from?
Okay. You must think I'm older than I am. I think I remember. So the question was, if the canopy's not true, then where did the water come from for the flood? Okay. Do you remember in the Garden of Eden it didn't rain? And the water welled up from the middle of the Garden of Eden and went out in four rivers to the ends of the earth? It's different than our rivers. Our rivers, they start in the mountains and they go down to the sea. Okay? And it looks like it's going to be that same way in the new heavens and new earth, you know, that the water is going to well up in Jerusalem, the administrative center of the new earth, and the rivers come out again and go to the ends of the earth, so forth. So how does hydrology work, you know, before the fall or, before, you know, Garden of Eden? And the answer is, I don't have any idea. Because it's not, I can't tell you scientifically. So if we have an accident out here in the parking lot, all right, and you T-bone me and so forth, the police come and they measure the skid marks and, you know, the trajectory of the cars, and they say, you were at fault, okay? You hit this guy and so forth. So they can do it scientifically. But if a car suddenly is miraculously, you know, sort of materializes in front of me, science can't say anything about that. Okay, there's no way scientifically I can tell you. So I don't know how much of this is miracle, how much is supernatural, how much is natural. And so the answer is nobody knows what it was like there. And plus the flood came and destroyed everything. Everything perished. And so everything's buried, and so it's going to be very, very hard to know what it's going to be like. But I think it's going to be like what we're going to see in the new heavens and new earth. So again, 10,000 years from now, we'll have an answer for you on that. Did that answer your question? Was there another part?
Well, the second part, where did
the... Oh, the flood came. The water came from. So, so Danny Faulkner, his theory is, he's the guy, the astronomer at AIG, okay? And so what he says is there's these big chunks of ice, that go around Saturn. And they come in and they hit Mars and cause a worldwide flood on Mars. There seems to be some evidence for that. Then it comes, it hits the Earth, it causes a one world, a flood on the Earth. And then they hit the near side of the Moon. And because we see spectroscopically, we see there's more water molecules on the near side of the Moon than on the far side of the Moon. So that's his evidence for that. Now, how you prove that, you know, scientifically, I don't know, but that's his theory. Another theory is Walt Brown's theory, the hydroplate theory, and that, you know, the fountains of the great deep break up. The Bible talks about the fountains of the deep before it talks about the rain. And so maybe it is that, you know, the crust of the earth is on this pool of water. It breaks up. The water shoots out of these cracks and then rains back down on earth. So the water is there all the time. It's just shooting out and then raining back on the earth from the cracks in the crust. So that's another way of doing it. So, I don't know. I wasn't there. I'm not old enough to know. But it's there. And so they need to explain where the water came from. Ask the evolutionists where the water came from and get some funny answers from them. Okay.
Thank you very much. Be sure to please, before you leave the building, thank the Mascos for the day. And we will see you again in the morning.
Yes.
Willing at 9:15.
And we have